Welcome to our afternoon session. We have a paper by Professor Christopher Cook, and the respondent is Dr. Massimo Renzi. And I think we should just get started.
So first, thank you very much to Seth and to the two other people, to David and the two other people whose names I'm forgetting now, who are the ELAC directors, and to the hospitality of Oxford. Thank you for your indulgence, or what I hope was your indulgence in an exercise in thinking out loud, or thinking in public, which probably ought to be discouraged. This paper is a beginning of an introduction to a book I'm trying to finish this year on democracy and war. And I found, I was just chatting about this at lunch, I found, and maybe as I move through the arc of a philosophical career, I become more and more beset by questions of methodology, that confidence I had in particular ways of framing problems and particularly more kind of axiomatic approaches to problems has waned over time. And this paper was a way of picking a particular topic and trying to nibble a little more around the edges of some of these methodological questions, in particular the relation between in a sense, the kind of the verdicts of history, the kind of the sociological legitimation of collective violence, and what moral philosophy and, I think, sort of intuition pump type examples bring to us, that discrepancy between the ways in which we forget violence. We forget it at the roots of our national histories. We forget it in relation to wars. Wars come to seem as options. That discrepancy between sort of the ideal theory of philosophy and the realism of war is something I've been thinking about for a long time and been unwilling to accept the answer that I was told myself at the beginning of a philosophical career, which is that philosophy should do what philosophy should do, say the way that things ought to be and let the world take note. I've become convinced that we need a more complicated relationship than that, and the paper is an attempt to think about that. But not terribly successfully. Seth also asked me to say a word about how the hell a paper about Jus Postbellum found its way into a Jus Ad Bellum conference. It came in part from not paying too much attention to the theme of the conference, apart from the title. Why we fight? Why do we fight? We fight to win. What do we want to do when we win? That was the question I gave myself. But there is also quite an obvious connection, and it's the one that I refer to the Gary Bass article from a couple of years ago that he highlights, that an unjust peace will vitiate an otherwise just war, and that we need to, I think this is right, though I take it in a different direction than Bass, I think we need to think about what the rights of victory are in order to argue back to what can be a just motivation for war. Because if, in fact, the rights of the victor are extremely limited, then it's hard to justify the waging of war as a device for securing deterrence, remaking institutions, and the like. The paper ends. So the paper moves through a number of ways of imagining how one might justify the rights of the victor now, the rights of the victor within international law have been constrained dramatically over history, but they're still we've moved past a right of pillage, rape, and revenge towards, well, I think we still have revenge, but towards still, I think, quite profound rights to reshape political institutions, and that it's really that core right of the victor to reshape political institutions. Which is, for me, the problem of justification. I try to consider a number of approaches to that problem and end up, I think, oscillating between two. The conclusion is not conclusory, the conclusion of the paper, is that we can think of two different approaches, two different ways that might be successful of justifying this. One is simply a duty to make sure that a people is governed, and if the victorious nation is the nation with the resources to do so, then it has a right that it extends no further than its duty to not leave a people it has vanquished in conditions of anarchy. That's one consideration. The second one is an attempt to still play out this thought I have that that political violence has, we have to think about it in a somewhat different way, that we have to recognize the relation between violence, the way violence and the creation of new regimes. We have to, in some sense, acknowledge that violence lies at the heart of the emergence of almost all political regimes, and to see victorious nations not as enjoying something that we would describe as a right. There's no clear moral justification for what they do, but as nonetheless occupying a kind of gray zone of in which there's a kind of frank acknowledgement that this is how politics happens. I'm treading in that suggestion over a paper I wrote a few years ago, trying to deal with the ticking time bomb question about how one thinks about supreme emergency cases and justifications in these cases. And in that other paper, which I don't think I said here, in that other paper I end up at a somewhat similar position, which is that it's hard to have confidence in moral principle, in the extension of moral principles to these cases, for obvious reasons. They seem more like singularities in our thought. It's hard to justify. It's hard, justify the torture. It's abhorrent to justify the torture, and yet there also seems to be something about the kind of the facticity of the case, the choice that has to be made, that that puts it in some different kind of normative space. I'm starting to babble here, but I think there is a similar. I'm intrigued by the thought that there's a similar kind of singularity in these moments of regime change, where we've lost the baseline for evaluating transformations to property in the case of some kinds of revolutions, and violence in others. That we need a different set of ethical principles to examine these kinds of cases than we're used to in the cases of interpersonal morality. So, sorry, that's kind of spewing a lot of the thoughts of the paper into the audience, and maybe Massimo can help clean them up and tell me what I thought.
All right. Well, thanks to Ilac and thanks to Seth in particular for putting together such a great event and for inviting me. And thanks to Chris for such a great paper. So, Kut's paper focuses on an interesting question of jus post bellum, namely the question of the justification of the rights of victors. These rights include things such as redrawing of territorial boundaries, relocations of populations, seizure and redistribution of property, imposition of reparative payments, punishment of leaders and officials, and so on. And Kut's question is, what is the justification for these rights? And this is an important question, he suggests, because if the requirement of jus post bellum are not met, the war will be unjust in spite of the fact that the requirements of jus ad bellum and jus in bello are met. So there are criteria of proportionality that the peace must meet in order for the war to be justified. So what is it that justifies the victorious state's right to interfere with the sovereignty of the defeated state in order to reshape its political institutions and punish its members and so on? There are two extreme answers. One is the no difference model. According to this view, victors acquire no rights by the fact that they won. All they have are the rights that they originally had before the war started, and the rights are acquired because of the wrongful acts committed by the losing state. So here, victory makes no normative difference. And Kutz rejects this view because it ought to be how we normally understand the rights of victors. We normally think that victors do acquire a limited right to govern the internal matters of the losing state. And on the other hand of the spectrum, there is the model that says that victors acquire a complete right to rule. Victors become sovereign over the territory of the losing state. So on this view, basically, they can do whatever they want, although on some modern versions of the model, they are constrained by natural duties of justice. And Kutz rejects plausibly, I think, this view as well as an instance of the view that might makes right, a view that empties the notion of right of substantive content. Now, in between these two extremes, there are a series of other views that he focuses on in his paper. The first group is what he called the epistemic foundations of the right of the victorious state. Now, leaving aside the strong theological interpretation of this view, there seem to be two formulations. One says that victory reveals which state was right before the beginning of the war. So the right of the victors is grounded on the fact that they won the war reveals that they were right in fighting the war. And there is a second formulation of this epistemic view that says that there is no straightforward answer to the question which state was right, but war is the decision procedure that determines that. And Kutz is sympathetic, to some extent at least, with this view. He says it's often more important simply to decide than to decide rightly, given that the conflict about who's right in many cases will have negative consequences. So given that establishing the antecedent rights of the parties is harder than we normally think, it is not implausible to think that war might function as the decision procedure to establish who is right, at least when we lack better decision procedures, for example, an international court. So I'll try to get back to this later if there's time. But I want to focus on the what he calls the substantive foundations of the right of the victorious state. And there are three formulations of this view. The victor's right to govern over the state that lost the war can be grounded in the right to deter future aggression by that state or by other states, or, and this is a second variant of this view, by the right to punish the wrongdoer. A second view says that the victor's right is grounded on the right to establish a superior mode of political life on the vanquished, and that there's a third view that says that the victor's right is grounded on the right to implement natural duties of justice. So, for example, to the duty to install a governing authority in the territory to ensure rule of law. Now, Kutz is sympathetic to the first view, at least in the formulation that focuses on deterrence, not with the one that focuses on punishing the victor. Since it would be to the advantage of all states to reduce the number of wars, the victorious state acquires the right to do things such as punishing leaders or reducing the military capability of the vanquished in order to deter the aggressing state as well as other states from future aggression. And of course, you know, this right must be balanced with respect for national self-determination of the state that lost the war. If I understand, he is also sympathetic, at least to some extent, to the second view. Once the conquered state has forfeited its ordinary presumption against interference through aggression, victors might have not only the right, but also the duty to reshape the conquered state and, where possible, establish a superior mode of political life. And of course, there are obvious risks here that Kutz acknowledges. What about the third view? Well, the third view is, at least in one interpretation, a weaker version of the second, so in a sense it's less controversial. Given the dangers incurred by those living in a territory with no functioning political institutions, victors plausibly have a duty to install some form of government to ensure that these dangers are prevented. Now, notice that this third view is completely independent from the jus ad bellum, and Kutz acknowledges this, in that it equally applies to whoever wins, whether it is the aggressing or the defending country. So a state responsible for moving an unjust war would have the duty not to leave the losing state without a government. And so for this reason, the third view does grant some duties, but these duties are grant for humanitarian intervention, but not a basis for legitimacy. So let me start with the substantive foundations of the right of the victors, and in particular with deterrence, as I think that this is the foundation that could seem to consider less controversial. Kutz starts from the observation that the right of a state to defend itself, triggered by an aggressive war, is as uncontroversial a ground of war as we can get, and that the right to deter once aggression has taken place follows closely on its heels. Why is that? His argument is that, I'm quoting now, given that fewer wars are better than more, a system in which aggression receives an additional sanction would be to the advantage of all states. And I think this formulation is important because it shows that the right is grounded in the well-being of all states, or if you prefer, in an impersonal demand of justice, the demand of justice to reduce the number of aggressive acts, since these are morally impermissible. And now my question is, well then, why should the state that won the war in particular enjoy this right? So if state A unjustly attacks state B, B certainly has the right to go to war in order to defend itself. But once this goal, namely self-defense, has been achieved, there is the separate problem of achieving a further goal, namely deterrence. I can see why this goal requires interfering with the sovereignty of the losing state, you know, why it requires punishing leaders and reshaping the constitution and so on. But what is the justification for B in particular having this right, given that the right is grounded in the interest of all states, or, as I said, in an impersonal demand of justice? Consider the right to put leaders on trial with the aim of deterring future aggressions. Why not give this right to an uninvolved state, if the uninvolved state would be able to do a better job? Why should A have this right if the tribunals of C or D would be more efficient in prosecuting and punishing the leaders? And indeed, we might think that there are very good reasons why animal states would do a better job than A, even if their respective tribunals are normally equally reliable. First thing, the tribunals of an animal state might be more impartial. Second thing, their decisions by me might be more easily accepted by the members of the defeated country who wouldn't be afraid of victor's justice. And the same is true in the case of the other two, in the other two substantive foundations that you consider. Indeed, I think my suggestion is even stronger in the case of the right to install a new government or a new mode of political life. Say that the goal is to alter the political constitution of the losing state. It seems to me that it would make sense to give the right to do so to the state best able to design the new constitution rather than to the victorious state. We should look, for example, for a state with a more developed legal culture, which would do a better job in designing the political institutions of the defeated state. As Kutz himself acknowledges, the right to install a new government is grounded in what he calls a can implies ought principle. These are principles defended by philosophers like John Finnis or Leslie Green. But in his own words, in Kutz's own words, these principles normally state that any party with the capacity to effect the rescue ought to do so. But then why select the victorious state in particular to effect the rescue? It seems to me that considerations of efficacy are normally what ground these duties and the following rights. So this is, for example, Leslie Green's view. Now, a possible reply that came to my mind when I was trying to think about this problem is that, well, I thought whatever particularizes the right of the state to defend itself will also particularize the right to deter the attacking state after the end of the war. But then I thought, wait a second, what is it that particularizes the right of the state to defend itself? And I'm not sure. I should confess I'm not an expert of this debate, so maybe there's an obvious reason that I'm just not aware of. But it seems to me that it might be argued that there are no moral reasons for this. It might be argued that attacked states have a right to defend themselves, but this right is not exclusive. In other words, it's just that normally other states are not keen in getting to war to defend states that are able to defend themselves, unless their interests are also threatened by the aggression somehow. But say that Geralt's protectors created their own state on Earth and would be willing to defend other states that are unjustly attacked, you know, and they would do this in the best possible way by respecting the requirements of using battle law, minimizing the killing, and so on, then I'm not sure that any of the attacked states would have the right to defend itself. The protectors would have the right. I think we can see this clearly in the case of individualized self-defense. Say that I'm attacked, and the only way I can defend myself is by killing the aggressor. But someone else next to me could defend me equally effectively without killing the aggressor. Now, I'm not sure that this person would have a duty to defend me. Maybe he would, but I don't know. But my suspicion is that if he was willing to defend me, then he would have the right to do so, and I wouldn't have the right to defend myself. Of course, I could be excused for doing so. And I guess my question is this view, does this make sense? And if it does make sense, I suspect that this view is equally true in the case of collective violence and in the case of individual violence. So I think that Kutz's remarks about the difference between the two is convincing and important, but I think the same conclusion would hold in both cases here. Now, if this view is correct, I suspect it wouldn't make much difference in the case of the right of states to defend themselves, but most likely would make a difference in the case of the duty to govern over the losing state in order to deter or to restore the rule of law or install a new government. Why is that? Well, I think that it wouldn't make a big difference in the case of the right of states to defend themselves because, as I said, states are not keen anyway in going to war to defend other states that are able to defend themselves. And when they do, we have all reason to suspect that they have an agenda. So even if I'm right, that other states would be better able to defend the attack state will probably have the right to defend itself for the simple reason that no other state will exercise this right. But when it comes to the right to govern the losing state in order to reshape its institutions or punish the leaders, animal states might be less reluctant to intervene, although again we should be wary of possible hidden agendas here. In these cases, I think the right to govern doesn't fall on the victorious state, but on the state best able to do the job. And think again about the parallel with the individual case. If I harm the aggressor, I certainly have a right to provide him with first aid, you know, a right to interfere with his physical integrity to provide first aid, which is grounded in the natural duty to rescue.
But if there's a doctor around, I have the duty to let the doctor deal with the aggressor. Now, if I'm right about all this, it seems that none of the substantive foundations considered by Kutz can ground the right of the victorious state to do any of the things that victorious states normally do. The right to install a government, to change a constitution, to punish the leaders, does not belong to the victorious state, but to whichever state is best placed to do these jobs. So the victorious state would have this right only if states better placed to do the job didn't fulfill their duty, say that they don't want to be involved, or if, as a matter of fact, the victorious state is the one best suited to realize these goals. But notice that even so, this would be a merely contingent fact. Even so, there would be no relationship between its right to govern and the fact that it won the war. Now, notice that this objection doesn't target the importance of using in bellum consideration in establishing that the war is just. What is targeted is rather the contrast that underlies Kutz's treatment of how we should think about jus post bellum. Kutz suggests that we should choose between two views. On the one hand, the view that victory grants specific rights for the victors, and on the other hand, the view that there is no link between just peace and just war, or, and I'm quoting now, that there's no field of right that to be constructed on the battleground. And I guess what I'm trying to say here is that conceptually there seems to be room for a third view, one that acknowledges that winning grants certain duties, which in turn grants certain rights to govern the losing country, but this right is not necessarily a right of the victors. And if I can just...
One or two minutes.
Yeah, just one final quick point. I'd like to hear a bit more about the relationship between just peace and just war. This is just clarification. So it could suggest that a peace that doesn't include enough reshaping of political institutions or of the incentives facing an aggressor's political institutions to deter future aggression will not justify its cost. I'm not sure I understand what this means. Say that country A is unjustly attacked by B, and A goes to war to defend itself. Now, A is capable of winning the war, meeting the conditions of jus in bellum, and jus in ad bellum conditions are met ex hypothesis. But A wouldn't be able to effectively reshape the political institutions of B. Say, you know, perhaps it's a well-known fact that B is divided by a long-standing internal fight. Now, is it permissible for A to go to war? How should we consider A's war? Is it justified? Is it just? I'd like to hear a bit more about this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It was wonderful. On the main part of your argument that the duty to rescue could be carried by anyone or whoever is best placed, that seems absolutely right in principle that this wouldn't be this or the duty to rescue isn't particularized to victorious state. It does imagine an international community with a capacity to do this kind of work, and I guess sort of the suppressed premise in this is that no such community is on the horizon. I mean, there are more multilateralism and more internationalism is clearly better. And I think in the case of the punishment of the punitive function, I think we're starting to see something like that. Although clearly there are. The international tribunals are identified with sort of winning parties in the minds of the punished countries. So it was really just an assumption that it's the victorious nation that's in the position, best position to do this, or is the likeliest volunteer, similar to the self-defense argument. I agree in principle that's something to incorporate into the paper. On the second point about, right, I think I just have...
Can I just say something? But I thought that your point was to establish some kind of link between the justification to do whatever it is required to do after the end of the war and the fact that that specific country won the war, but there's no connection.
In that case, the connection is, right, it becomes purely the contingency.
It's contingent, yeah.
Yes, it becomes purely contingent, yeah.
So it's not the right of the victor, it's the right of whoever can do it.
Right, the victor happens to be the closest to the scene. No, that's exactly right. And yeah, that the point of that duty argument is to, in effect, try to break the notion of a kind of a right to rule. So I take that as actually a very friendly amendment and very helpful. On the question of, I think I have a line where I say, right, it seems to me that war won with insufficient sort of future-going deterrence is unjustified, and it was simply a thought that the war won't have been worth fighting. The costs of the war, the human costs to both nations, won't have been worth incurring if another war is coming down the pike. So that the extraordinary costs of war need to be balanced out by a long-run benefit of deterring future aggression. And that it was simply that thought that that inadequate deterrence post-war will mean that the game wasn't worth the candle, that the costs of war weren't, in fact, worth occurring. So, I don't know if you have a thought about that.
It seems to me that what to make the war unjustified would be not the fact that not enough wars are prevented in the future, but if anything, would be that some serious bad consequences would happen in the future. So it's not the fact that we wouldn't be able to prevent other killings that might make the war unjustified, but if anything, would be the fact that other killings would follow somehow. So the fact, it seems to me that a war can be justified if, we can protect certain goods, or if the state is liable and so on. And if these considerations are in place, the fact that that's still not enough to prevent future wars doesn't seem to me particularly...
And it depends on how one specifies the range of future wars. It's clearly not any future war. It's future wars against this territory that I have in mind. Yeah.
Should we open up for discussion?
Sure.
This is kind of a question. It's almost more directed to Massimo. It's kind of after his, I think, very intelligent discussion. You say that when you're talking about the right to kind of rebuild, if you like, you say it's the best place to do the job. I think that's probably a bit too demanding. I think you'd want to say that it's the agent that's got the right to is anyone that meets a certain threshold of particular conditions. So you might think that any agent that is going to establish decent political institutions, do punishment, whatever. So I think you can conceive it as a threshold, and then certain agents, a whole host of agents, then may have the right to be able to act. Then when it comes to determining which agent has actually got the particular duty, then you might say, well, it should be the one that's best placed. So you might have a situation, for instance, where A and B can both establish, both do a really good job of rebuilding, but A can do it a tiny bit better than B. Now, we'd think, well, both of them have surely got the right to be able to do it, but when you're actually saying, well, which one's got the duty, well, you think, well, okay, maybe A, because A is going to do a better job. So it's just it's a different, so I think when you're talking about the right and the duty, and which one's best placed on the threshold. Another quick point I had was about, I wonder what your thoughts, both of your thoughts are about which particular wars here in question. So do defensive wars differ from humanitarian wars? So when you engage in a war of humanitarian intervention, it's sometimes suggested that those that engage in wars of humanitarian intervention have got, they should take on the burdens of kind of rebuilding afterwards. And this is a kind of common claim that's made. Responsibility to protect doctrine seems to imply this as well, but this might seem to kind of lead some kind of thought that, well, there is some sort of difference between humanitarian wars and defensive wars, but on the other hand, you might think, well, surely this is asking a lot of humanitarian beings as well, because, well, not only do they have to actually engage in humanitarian intervention, then they have to pick up the whole bill of rebuilding. So I'm not quite sure what I think about it, but I just wondered what your thoughts were.
Yeah. Actually, Massimo, did you want to answer?
You go first.
On the first point, I was going to say you might think that there is a special privilege that an international organization would have if such an organization with that capacity existed, that it would have a privilege over sort of more partisan states to engage in the rebuilding, precisely because it could be seen to be less interested in the particularities of the outcome. As I said, I don't pay attention to that because it didn't seem to me that any such institution was really a viable player here. But I think there might be a reason to think that it won't be simply a function of capacity, but of a distinctive kind of standing.
I agree with you. There might be a whole host of factors that you want to take.
Multilateralism would clearly enter into that. The humanitarian. It's true that the once the sort of the bill for humanitarian intervention increases, you make it much less likely it's going to happen. That can seem unfair to the rescuer. I mean, there are all sorts of situations. I mean, I think this is a sort of, it's a, one of the general kind of paradoxes of Good Samaritanism, that, you know, wading into a problem can land you with a whole host of responsibilities. That seems to be a kind of a feature of the case, that once one has interrupted sovereignty, accepted the duty to stop a genocide from taking place, you have the responsibility to make sure that it won't take place, that it, not just that it stop at the moment, but that it won't take place as soon as you leave, and that unfortunately requires a great deal of rebuilding. Now, humanitarian interventions do make it legitimate to call on other nations for support in this effort, and that so there's no reason to think that the intervening state has stuck with the bill, but it does have a distinctive responsibility by being in the midst of it.
As to the first point, I'm not sure. I was thinking, say that state A and state B could do a pretty good job, but A would do a slightly better job, only a slightly better, but we are talking about realizing justice, so there would be less justice that is realized on the country if B does the job than if A does the job. Now, say that A is willing to do the job, and B, do you think that it's permissible for B to do the job instead? It's not just about the duty. I think it's also about, it also affects permissibility, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably is. If you've got a kind of
enough justice realized.
Yeah.
Do you have a finger?
Quick. Yeah, it is about this relationship between right and duty, and I think here what you said about humanitarian might be applicable more widely, in the sense that I think I also tend to think that there is a threshold above which, because I don't think we have just one state which is like the perfect state, or one liberal idea which is just, there is just one way to create. I think there has to be some kind of threshold. So maybe anyone above a certain threshold can do a good job and therefore would have a right. But I think actually that the duty is not on the one that is best placed, but rather on the one that intervened to begin with, even if it was for self-defense. And that's a connection that I think exists, because even if you intervene because your state A was unjustly attacked, and so it intervenes. But once it intervenes, now it has a special relationship with the people in state B. And so unlike any other state that might see D or an E, all of them can put in place a just institution more or less above a certain threshold. State A has a special relationship, and therefore state A has not only a right, but also a duty to do it. Whereas others, I'm not sure that, so let's say now two countries on the other side of the world fight. So England now has a responsibility to come in, and even if, let's say, England is best placed to put the best just system. It just seems to me like we are dragging people from, or states in this case, from all over the world. Suddenly they all have duties to intervene and place just institutions, which seems to me taking it a bit too far in terms of, there is a basic humanitarian, if there is genocide or something like that, you might say all countries have some kind of responsibility. But beyond that, I'm not really sure that we can really create duties which create demands. I think we can create a right. And if they choose to intervene, that's fine. And the state that in fact intervenes should have a duty, whereas others would only have a right.
Based in basically its causal responsibility for having destroyed the institutions.
Exactly.
Okay, I think we should if you want to make it.
How about my case of individual self-defense? When I defend, but in defending myself, I harm the aggressor, but there's a doctor who could, and I could do something to help the aggressor.
Well, if the doctor does not have, so the doctor is not responsible.
No.
I don't think he necessarily has a duty. I think doctors have by profession possibly, but let's say someone else who just knows
not
a bit
doctor,
more.
But
I don't think he necessarily has a duty as such to come and help. Maybe if he's a good person, but I'm not sure that I'm willing to impose on him duties that include costs and things like that and say he's responsible. You have a special responsibility because you've caused the damage.
Okay, Victor?
Nah. That's probably right.
Next one?
But that's not my point. I wanted to have a look at the claim that says that, or the thought that says that we can identify who was on the just side by looking at who won, mm-hmm. which seems like it's absurd.
Yeah.
This gives us good reason to defend it, right? Because you
right.
get extra points
right.
in credibility for defending absurd claims. So this looks like an argument for that view. We know that the side that lost did something that was objectively unjust, right? Because they launched a war where they didn't achieve their aims. And we know that success is part of the conditions for fighting a just war. So they just sent all of their people off to get slaughtered, and they've done it for no reason. They haven't fulfilled any of their aims because they've lost, right? And then we think, well, the side that won has fought against a country that sent all these people off to get slaughtered for no good reason. And that gives us some reason to think that they were on the just side. Right? It's not a very strong reason, but it's some reason to make us think that they're on the just side. If we don't know anything else, then we have on balance reason to think they were on the just side.
Sorry, is the thoughts of moral luck thought that the success retrospectively validates the war, or it adds to the way
it's just that we know that they fought against an objectively unjust country, because they sent all these people to slaughter for no reason.
Yeah.
Right? So they're not looking after their citizens very well, are they? They've sent them all off to get killed, and they haven't achieved any of their aims. So we know they're pretty bad, and we've got some reason to think the other side is on the just side, because they fought against this country that was willing to do that.
Jeff had a finger.
Well, they could conceivably have achieved, the loser could conceivably have achieved most of what it set out to achieve, but nevertheless lost the military contest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's a possibility.
Could have done, so it's just for some reason. I'm not saying this is, lots of other reasons to think they may be on the unjust side. There are lots of other facts, but we...
Isn't it prospect of success, not success, that is the just war criteria?
It could have been subjectively justified, but objectively unjustified, right? We just take it that the fact that someone's objectively unjustified gives us some reason to think they were subjectively unjustified too, right?
David had a finger.
I mean, I think you're right about the objective unjustification of the side that lost, but the mistake is to assume that tells us anything about the justification of the other side. This is exactly your point from earlier in the day. That
that's your point.
And it tells us nothing about the justification of the other side.
Of course it does.
It might just tell us both of them.
You already know this fact about a country. A country's gone to war, and you know just this fact about them. Either they fought against someone who sent all of their people to mass slaughter for no reason, or they fought against someone who didn't do that.
But
and just that fact alone gives us some reason to believe that they were on the just side.
There's one last finger in response to your ludicrous point.
That is unfair, Jerry. That is such mean, Jerry.
Last finger?
It's just an elaboration at this point. So suppose that a weak country starts a military conflict with a strong country, with the warring of drawing the international communist attention to the problem and then solve it afterwards.
This is the mess that worked.
Yeah, so that would be a case where it's not just some reason to believe that the losing side, militarily speaking, has started an unjust war.
I think maybe we should move on.
Okay.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Chris, for a really engaging paper. So my question is, I think it's essentially an objection that Alex Bellamy raised to use postbellum in general, I think in a 2003 article. And it's about where exactly use postbellum begins. So I think the objection kind of hinges on this question of humanitarian interventions, where what often happens is we end up with two options. So we have a peace settlement that signifies the end of the war, and the end of conflict, I suppose. But doesn't specify a victor, right? The other alternative is that the demands, their pragmatic needs for territorial administration or political reconstruction that happen before the end of the war, right? And so I wonder if this sort of backs this argument into a corner, and that if you have this pragmatic need for territorial administration, does that then kind of defeat the particularization argument that you're making? That I suppose right, if, so if there aren't clear victors yet, is it possible? Is there a right? Can you confer a right on something, I suppose, that doesn't exist yet?
Right. Okay. So before the victory has been acquired. Well, so I mean, this is. I mean, I take it this is a version of Massimo's. I mean, it's another version of the challenge. I don't feel like I have anything at stake in the particularization argument. I'm trying to come up with some way of thinking about what has been a practice of the victory state asserting its right, and whether or not, and if it might be that other states are enjoy that right or distributed, maybe true. I mean, I'm intrigued by the causal responsibility argument. I have tended to be somewhat skeptical of causal responsibilities grounding much of anything in responsibility generally. So I'm not inclined to jump at that, but that's clearly the easiest way to particularize the argument. But on the Massimo version of this, clearly victory has no significance at all. It simply is whoever has the resources to bear to solve the humanitarian problem, and that seems right.
Dan?
Chris, thank you. I thought this was a very interesting paper. On page 23, the last paragraph before the conclusion, you say this. For instance, whatever the justice of Iraq War II, once the U.S. had destroyed its institutions of governance, it had a duty to rebuild them. Well, it's an interest. I realize you may have been referring to a moral duty as opposed to a legal duty, but good lawyer that I am, I read that as you referring to a legal duty. And I'm wondering whether you feel that, for example, there needs to be some kind of just post-bellum Geneva Convention or additional protocols to the Geneva Convention or other kind of codification to the law of conflict. And if so, what legal duties would be imposed?
Yeah, so no, I was referring to a moral duty, right? And I guess I was pulled very strongly by the causal intuition. Yeah. My sort of reaction is that any international document that will come out will fantasize an international process that will do this, and such a process won't work, and so this is not the most useful exercise. But that may be too cynical. The legal duty would be to ensure that an occupied territory has functioning representative institutions that can provide for the basic rights of its citizens, and it's a more robust set of occupation guidelines. This is among the forms of reconstruction that need to take place. Reconstructing water supply infrastructure and so on is reconstructing governmental infrastructure in a way that leads to a reasonably representative government. Do you have a response to that, or a thought about that?
Well, that raises other issues. I mean, for example, if an occupying power has that kind of a duty, I'm also wondering whether eventually that could lead to a duty to remain there for indefinite periods of time until certain institutions and structures are built. So, I mean, it's a great idea. It's not free of problems itself.
No, clearly.
Two very brief fingers, Michael and Patrick.
Right. Would you distinguish between occupation and just defeat? In other words, there are laws of belligerent occupation that make certain allowances and impose certain duties about keeping the infrastructure functioning and so forth, as opposed to just defeating a country without really occupying it.
Without pulling back out. Right.
Maybe not even pulling in. Maybe doing it by
for remote bombardment.
Aerial bombardment or some other situation. Would it be the same kind of obligation then? If there's an obligation?
Yes, I mean, this right, the obligation to rebuild would be independent of, I mean, it wouldn't rest on duties of occupation. It would be a function of having destroyed a country's infrastructure, or alternatively, that infrastructure having been destroyed, it might, on the internationalist theory.
Mm-hmm. Patrick?
When you sort of look at the legal transplant literature and how difficult it is to transplant effective institutions, and even like the transition in Central and Eastern Europe, I think any legal duty would have to be pretty cautiously framed, having that in mind. But I think your characterization of the moral duty, you have to be pretty sensitive to the sociological realities that, particularly exploiting the rule of law,
right.
Or even in optimal peaceful conditions, occupation conditions, which I think you sort of noted in your paper, that now seem to be maybe coming back to you from in your comments.
Yeah, no, I certainly, right, no, I can't remember where, but yeah, the possibility of success is so low that that's one, right, it's a reason to be skeptical that any robust duty could exist. On the other hand, the alternative, the walk away position, that the victor has freedom to walk away or to intervene, seems to me too unconstrained as well. So, I mean, as I said, the paper reflects an impasse in my thought, and I guess, I'm still circling around here.
Henry.
I'm afraid this is going to be a string of unrelated sentences, but I'm trying to sort of draw you out on what, in your opening remarks, was the comment about facticity and taking it seriously, or kind of start way back. One thing that worries a lot of people about the UN Charter principle for the resort to war is that because it says wars have to be in self-defense, it doesn't allow wars which undo injustice and make the world more just than it is otherwise. And I take it that one argument for the UN position is that although we do want to make the world more just than it is, war is such a terrible thing that there's a limit to the kind of cleaning up we want to do at the cost of having more and more wars. And so it's on the whole better to just leave some injustices where they are,
right,
if it saves us from more wars. On page 14, you talk about Fulgosius and say, he recognized the defect of the more heavily moralized just war tradition, that the insistence on the rectitude of one and only one party of conflict would tend to undermine the capacity of war to settle an issue, and then talk about the value of closing the books. And so I wonder if this is supposed to be getting at the facticity. If part of the point here isn't that there is value in closing the books. Now, this would be within limits, right? I mean, since you and I don't think God is actually manipulating and guaranteeing who wins, we're not willing to settle for just any victory by just anybody, but it's kind of within reasonable limits, and that's sort of how I take the UN thing. Presumably.
Yeah.
What we're thinking is it's a better thing that the fighting stop, and so, and I'm not sure whether you're saying this or not, and so we might grant the victor a little bit of something, privilege, right, maneuver room, so that the victor could do some stuff to just kind of clean up a little bit, even if the wrong side had won, even, let's say,
yes,
provided that what he did wasn't too awful.
Right.
Sort of, I mean, does this make, I don't know.
Right, no, it's, right, it's a, right, the, that's the, sort of the war is the decision procedure idea, that it's, we grant the right to the victor to redraw, and I was thinking particularly of territorial boundary issues, to redraw the territorial boundary, perhaps to, restructure, to, perhaps to add in some deterrence components as well, in order to make the conflict cease. May not work, but that that would be the argument for letting the victor have that right. It's a way of settling the issue in the absence of an international institution. I mean, would be, or some other third party authority who can settle the issue.
The rationale is not that there was a pre-existing right answer, and God saw to it that the war got us the right answer. It's just that enough.
There may or may not be a pre-existing right answer, but it's premised on that we're not going to know what that is. We don't have any way to decisively settle the issue by reference to its rightness, only by reference to who's actually victorious. But that's better than the alternative.
Yeah.
I was wondering if we take one. I love the paper, and all of your writings I appreciate as an army officer, this desire to to take seriously Ogden Place can, and to try to sort of meet the institutions halfway with principled philosophic engagement. I wonder if we take the notions of asymmetry seriously, and sort of the moral primacy of just cause, if that might lead us to see that there might actually be different accounts for JPB based on different just causes. So mm-hmm. we might not have a one-size-fits-all JPB. You could sort of have the JPB for the unjust side that's victorious, that sort of minimizes bad people running around and doing bad things, which is a good thing, obviously. And then an armed humanitarian version of JPB, and then a more paradigmatic national defense version of JPB mm-hmm. that's more punitive model. What do you think about that?
So certainly it makes sense to think humanitarian intervention claims will have a different, or we might have different code than sort of border disputes. There will be all sorts of reasons for thinking that the issue of neighborliness or cross-border aggression isn't as significant, and so on. My way into the Philodosius passage in the middle was the doubt that we can settle to all parties. Contentment, whether the just side or the unjust side won in the dispute.
Right.
There might be an immediate border incursion, but that will be premised in some anterior claim. So I'm not sure that we could have a body for when the bad guys win and a body of principles for when the good guys win.
Yeah.
If we can't settle who's who after the fact. So that seems to me precisely what we want to avoid, that we need a uniform set of rules that acknowledges that in a perfect world, we're not in the perfect world in which we can make these determinations.
Right, so bracketing sort of the winner being just and who's the winner and those sorts of things, we certainly can tell the difference between an armed humanitarian intervention and a paradigmatic war of national defense.
Yes.
And think that, even if somebody's mistaken, war of national defense turns into an armed humanitarian intervention.
Right. Right. Well, we don't. Yeah. Right. There'll be a special issue if you can kind of bootstrap your way from an unjust aggression into a humanitarian intervention and then incur greater rights of. It's a wonderful suggestion. Okay.
I actually have a question regarding the relationship between rights and duties, and I just assume that it's a war of national self-defense and the just side won. Let's take the Second World War as an example. That the victor won and that he has a right. What would you say for the following example, that let's say France was obviously not victorious, but they suffered a lot. Now let's imagine that the United States, let's just simplify, the United States won the war, and so they could determine how Germany should be shaped. And one idea is obviously, which I think is intuitively plausible, that somehow those who suffered from the war, from the unjust war, have a right to reshape the aggressing country in a way that, as you said, makes it more unlikely that this will happen again. So I would think the French had a right to that, or the Polish, but they were not victorious. I would just be curious, then would one say that the right belongs to the victorious or those who suffered the most? And just the other way around, because then you switch to the duty, the duty to rebuild. But then I would think, was there a duty to listen to the Germans how their country was to be rebuilt? I mean, in the end it worked out, but some more dramatic versions of how to reshape Germany, like the Morgenthau Plan. Would it have been unfair to do it that way? I mean, would there have been a duty to institutionalize a liberal democratic society, or did the Germans somehow forfeit their right in a way? So the duty, it was always from the actor who helps, but I would be interested, is there a duty, even with an unjust aggressor, to come somehow give them the just society?
On the last point, on the unjust the unjust aggressor.
Yeah, the Germans.
Was there a duty to actually provide them?
Yeah. Let's say that somebody would have made the argument, well, it's not about about justice in Germany, it's just about that we make a more peaceful Germany, and if there are kind of, another
kind of government would secure that in a better way, then we have no duty towards the Germans. It's rather about our defense against them. So on the first one, it does seem to me that, yeah, as I say, we're back to the issue of particularity of whether, in the one sense, Stalin had clearly a right to be at the table. In the other sense, it's hard to imagine a worse possible party to participate in the reconstruction of Germany. But the particularity issue is very real, and I don't have a good resolution for that. It does seem that the Allied parties had a particular right to engage in this form of reconstruction, and of necessity that goes by way of Germany as well, not the defeated German government, but the German people needed to be included, the Iraqi people need to be included in the process of rebuilding institutions, because those institutions have to be representative institutions, and that's part of the premise of the duty of rescue. So the people of the defeated state have a right, also a duty, to govern themselves. Have a right to participate in that, as do the parties around there. The interesting case is the one in which the parties with a right to participate in the reconstruction are actually not just marginally less able than other interveners, but clearly very inferior to other possible interveners in this process of reconstruction. I have to think about that problem.
Very quickly, Patrick. Very quickly.
Why does the duty of rescue require representative institutions rather than not just functioning institutions that will keep the peace?
It's not, because I was thinking of it as more robust than, I analogize it to a duty to rescue, that it's, you know, loose on the scene, but the duty of natural justice is a duty to, and it's just this Kantian idea that it's a duty to create just institutions.
Laura?
Yeah, I have an observation that goes back to some of the things that Massimo said, and I think the considerations about causality that Shlomit brought out. So you're talking about the rights of the victors, but the more we were discussing this issue, the more the idea of a right seemed to me to be somewhat misplaced, just because rather than it being a privilege for the victor, it looks like they have to take on a lot of burdens, like that the right is actually a right to reconstruct and to set up a functioning state. And so I was wondering whether, instead of conceptualizing the issue in terms of the right of the victors, it would make more sense to think of it in terms of the sort of remedial responsibilities that follow from the fact that this terrible thing has happened, maybe war, and that a particular country or society has been destroyed. And the idea of remedial responsibility I'm getting from David Miller, and when we think about remedial responsibilities, there are many different grounds for it. And one might be moral responsibility in case the attacker was culpable, but it could also be causal responsibility, as Shlomi pointed out, benefiting. So if you've not contributed to this particular war, but in a way or another you've benefited from this war, then you might have a duty to contribute to rebuilding. It can be your capacity, which is, I think, what Massimo was hinting at. And Miller also mentions community. So if you have particular communal ties to state that has been half destroyed or something, then you might have an extra reason to intervene. So that's just an observation.
Thank you. Right. I mean, that the idea of this other strategy of justifying the right of the victor was to do it by way of seeing the right as grounded in a duty rather than as grounded in some other sort of power.
I'm not sure you need to be so concessive. I mean,
is that a concession?
Not a concession, but it seems to me that the right could be seen as, you know, robust as a right that is correlating to duties on the part of third parties, and in particular duties owed not merely to the country which is being rebuilt and its population, but to the victims themselves, not to interfere with them. Mm-hmm. In the task of reconstruction, and in particular not to take up arms again, you know, as insurgents against mm-hmm. the victor, particularly when the victor is there in the form of occupying, you know, forces. So I think it can be more than a bare privilege, understood as a right, you know, in that sense.
Yeah, well, certainly, right, on this strategy of argument, oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Right.
Yeah, no, on this strategy of argument, you know, which it seemed to me one of the two more promising paths the duty-based one, right? It will entail specific rights, rights to commandeer resources for this reconstruction, as well as you say, rights to insist on non-interference.
Crescenta had a finger on that.
Just to piggyback off of Cecile, when we're thinking about duties and responsibilities of the intervening party or the victor, we forget that local ownership with rebuilding political institutions is key. And if you don't have that, you don't have the reconstruction. So how do you, it's very difficult, and it needs to be done, how do you get around saying that something is a duty when in order to fulfill this duty, it requires another actor who you really have no control over. You hope that the local population will own the reconstruction, but if they don't, they cannot fulfill this duty. So is it a limited, would you call it a limited duty, a limited responsibility, or how do you get around the local ownership factor?
Right, this is a different version of Patrick's point, that the success is unlikely in any event, so how can we specify a duty? I mean, it's a separate version because it relies on a third party performing its role as well. We can re-specify the duty as a duty to try, in effect. I mean, you can, but to make best efforts to create institutions that will function.
Uwe.
Yeah, my question refers to what Laura just said. I'm just curious how stringent the so-called duties of the victor of reconstruction are. I mean, suppose there's a woman married basically to an asshole and he beats her all the time, and however, he also provides for her, you know, he buys the food and he pays the rent and so on. At one point, he's about to kill her, and I come in there and save her, kill her, him, of course. would I now be, I don't think that I would be under legal duty nor under moral duty now to provide for the woman to do what the guy did before. So I don't see why in the state case, if we let the domestic analogy stand, why an intervener who saves somebody, for example, from genocide, should that be, then be responsible for then providing institutions or something for those they saved?
Right. I mean, all of the sort of, it's a common feature of these benevolence cases that they raise these issues of fairness, and sort of what's a fair imputation. I mean, does the person who says it seems on, you know, there's a general, in fact, it's a general principle of institutional life that good citizens are punished for their goodness, and that free riding is rewarded.
You think he has the duty to provide for her, or what?
Yes, I think that when you step into a problem, you incur a set of responsibilities that are not just, I mean, they come from a range of hosts. They're not. My sense is that causation is too normatively inert to do the work, but that there are a range of reasons to think that immersion in a problem situation comes with a host of further responsibilities. This is sort of the paradox of benevolence, and there are principles of fairness that can allow us to say this is unfair. That I can make a claim on the aid of others to help rectify the situation, but we can't simply walk away having given a small amount of aid if more is left there. Can't pull the drowning child out of the pool and leave him to die of exposure. You need to take that further step as well.
Two quick fingers on that, Patrick and James, sorry, and Victor.
Yeah, I just to agree with you and to make clarifications, I think it's going to help. The reason why you might think in the case of Iraq that we do have duties. We have duties of reparation. So we've got duties to clear up the mess we've made. So you might think that unjust states that have fought unjust wars have duties to clear up whatever they caused. In Uwe's example, if you went in there and then broke the woman's arm, broke your callousness in helping her, then you might have a duty to kind of, then you might gain a duty. But I don't see why. If you've done everything right, you have the burdens. Why should you have to have the burdens? It just seems very counterintuitive.
There's more complexity in here. So, there's some cases. This isn't absurd, I promise. Well, maybe Janina will tell me. I know. So there are cases where it's wrong to intervene unless certain conditions obtained. So you go and save a person, but you can make someone else worse off as a result. And then it's permissible to save the person only on condition that you don't make this person worse off, and you don't make them worse off if you go and help them afterwards. And that might be true in some war cases. It's permissible to save your own citizens, but only on condition that you don't make some other people worse off. And then you incur the duty in going toward defending yourself to these other people to make them better off. There are other cases where that just turns out not to be true. Mm-hmm. And then you don't incur the duty. And you know, we need to know a bit more about how we're going to distribute some of these costs in some of these cases. Sometimes it's going to look fair that causal responsibility makes this big difference. Sometimes it's going to look really unfair. It does. So my suggestion is just that we just think about distribution of the costs and who should incur them in a slightly more complicated way when thinking about these ex-ante considerations.
Jeff?
Yes. Two very quick points. First, sometimes a victor's rights may derive from the just cause which justifies the resort to war in the first place. So one example might be that after a war has ended, the other side has surrendered and so on, the side, the just side that has fought may have a right to effect complete disarmament of the defeated enemy to prevent any further threat in the future. And this could arise from the nature of the grievance that justified the resort to war in the first place. This is the only way to eliminate the threat that was posed. Second point is that in the case of a just war, a defense against an aggressor, as in the case of British against the Germans of World War II. In that kind of case, even though the Allied powers did actually contribute to the reconstruction of Germany in various ways, it wasn't something to which one would say that the Germans had any right to claim. So I think there's certainly has to be a limit to at least the our understanding of the sources of whatever you think the duty may be to aid in reconstruction and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. In the case of World War II, certainly the right thing to do, certainly worked out for the best in some ways. Hard to claim that Germany was owed that by right. Mm-hmm.
So on the first point, I certainly agree that some antecedent rights will flow through the war to create posterior rights. So if a state A had a right to a certain border, there's a takeover of that land. State A wins the war. They have a right. They have the right they had to the border they had. The question will be whether they have a further right to a buffer zone around that border and so on. And that was the sort of question I was interested in. But the threat issue is actually the disarmament one seems to me to be precisely the point that calls for the further elaboration of the victor's right, because State A didn't have an antecedent right to disarm State B because of a threat that State B posed, and that's the preventive war rationale that seems to fall outside the just war, the just cause ambit to take out a gathering threat. It wasn't until the war began that they acquired this further right to intrude into the disarmament process, to impose a disarmament. That's how I see it. So winning the war, or the fact that there was a war, made a difference to the right they had to impose a disarmament on the other party. On the second point, Germany didn't have a claim on the Allies. Germany as a state may not have been in a moral position to make such a claim, but Germans had a claim, the claim of rescue is what I'm suggesting. They had a claim not to be left in anarchy. And so been having this interesting discussion of whether that's a claim on the world or a claim that's specific to the Allied parties. I'm still scratching my head about that. But it does seem, I want to say that the people of the defeated state do have a right to that form of assistance.
Okay, just a quick reply. I used to think about the aim of prevention of future aggression in the way that you're suggesting, mm-hmm. that is that I refer to it as a conditional just cause for war, that is one that it's an aim that is permissible to pursue by means of war only if there's some independent just cause that justifies the resort to war and then activates the further
right.
just aim. I'm no longer think that's the right way to think about it, and I actually think that there can be cases where preventive war is justified, though in practice it's probably better to require some kind of further just aim, like needing an actual act of aggression. I probably think prevention and deterrence are both these difficult kind of aims that we do think can be pursued in war, but whether or not they have to be, the right has to be activated by some other kind of consideration, I think is
so you would
an
see
issue
the
on which we probably disagree now as a matter of theory.
So you would see the act of aggression by the other party as just having a kind of epistemic significance, as proving that there really is a very significant threat, a threat that's sufficient to...
Well, I think it may be a just aim, you know, it may create a just aim on its own, that is to defeat the initial aggression, but also there's this other aim that is also justifiable to pursue by means of war.
There was a finger on this. Oh, sorry. No, keep going.
It may have stood on its own. Mm-hmm. Again, I agree with you to this extent that about the case of the Germans. Certainly, innocent people in Germany have a claim to rescue. In a case in which such a high proportion of the adult population is implicated in various ways in the war that their state was fighting, I think that diminishes claims to assistance. But on the point of principle, I think you're right. Particularly with innocent people in a defeated state, you clearly are right.
Yeah, actually, I would just say it seems to me actually a universal human right—a right to governance, to effective governance.
Did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I just want to know what happens if the claim to rescue collides with the claim to deter future aggression? Because you talk about deterrence in terms of reshaping political institutions and providing new institutions. But on the other hand, deterrence is about a credible force now to prevent somebody from doing something in the future.
Yeah.
That force becomes credible because we destroy infrastructures now. So
right.
In the future, you won't risk it. So the deterrence is going to go out the window if I say, well, I'm going to destroy your infrastructures, but don't worry, I'll rebuild them.
Mm-hmm.
So whose rights trump this here?
I thought you were going in a different place, which I was also
let's go there.
Worried about. Yeah. right. The it depends on the infrastructure. So eliminating military infrastructure seems to be that was
the deterrence is also
what I had in mind.
Destroying civilian infrastructures.
Yes. No, the other tension I had in mind is what if the representative institutions that you install are quite likely to bring about an even more hostile regime to operate a conflict with deterrence in that sense.
Too.
Yeah. Right, those two can clearly come at each other, and I'll have to think about that. I don't know.
David?
Of course.
Might be enough to deter, to destroy the infrastructure, even if you rebuild them, right? So it might be that you will need to give an argument to why destroying the infrastructure, even if then you rebuild them, could not be enough to deter. It might be that would be enough.
It's like rehabilitation doesn't ruin deterrence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It might. Okay.
Yeah. Where you need your rehabilitation not to be cushy enough for your infrastructure.
Damn it.
Yeah, so it was just a quick follow-up on Bob Underwood's point. So Bob was saying that if you're inclined to take asymmetry seriously, you might want to think about different kinds of jus postbellum regimes for different kinds of ad bellum status interventions and postbellum situations. And your response to that was, well, that might be okay if we had some kind of impartial epistemic body that could tell you which ones are just and which ones are unjust, but if we don't, we have to have some kind of, you know, leveling.
account that doesn't differentiate in that way. And it seems to me that one of the mistakes that that makes, which I think a lot of the anti-asymmetry arguments do make, is that it assumes that the only, or perhaps the primary target for these kinds of rules are the person whose behavior will be directly, whose behavior directly ended. It seems to me that these rules can play, importantly, other functions as well. So one of the things that they do is that they guide the response of third parties, right? Other nations, other states, international agencies, when they're considering how to interact with, recognize, intervene in the postbellum activities of the occupier, right? So a set of rules to differentiate on the basis of these ad bellum considerations could still be important in terms of the judgments that these third parties will make about the actions of the occupier or of the victim.
Right, so the image is this, that we have a pronouncement made by some third party that the right side won, or the wrong side won, and
right,
that certain privileges are extended or they're not.
Right, it's just that, third parties, other states, they will make their assessment, right? And
yeah.
So the question is, ought they to be guided by their assessment of the ad bellum justice? It seems to me that in a lot of circumstances it might be entirely appropriate that they should be guided.
Yeah,
even,
I mean...
Even if we don't have a kind of McMahonian... partial authority to make that call.
Right, I guess I'm just I can imagine institutions which render verdicts, but it seems to me those verdicts are likely to be contested, so deeply contested in virtually all cases, you'll have conflicting institutions rendering conflicting verdicts, or you'll have dissatisfaction with those verdicts. And that was that was what lay behind my saying to Bob that it seemed to me one wants a uniform set of delineations of the rights of the victor, that not rather than an asymmetric set, which depend on some third-party endorsement, because the more expansive set of rights will be deeply contested. But in principle, one could have such a set of institutions.
But wanted to come on that.
Just maybe perhaps an example of what David's talking about, just to sort of contextualize it completely. If we had an army that had a robust moral doctrine, and in that moral doctrine was a doctrine of use postbellum based on asymmetry, and I get some sort of order from my national command authority saying that the war is this specific sort of thing, well, use postbellum seems to me a way to think of it is the necessary and sufficient conditions to satisfy the just cause,
mm-hmm.
at least one of the things that we consider use postbellum. And so if my national command authority is telling me that my just cause for war is a certain sort of thing, let's say paradigmatic national defense, and I go and I consult my doctrine to start to do my planning, and then lo and behold, I start to notice bits of sort of recalcitrant data and these sorts of things that say, well, look, you say that I'm going to do these other sorts of things, but we don't see those conditions sort of on the ground in our planning, right? This seems to be, one, either it doesn't meet the use ad bellum criteria that you're talking about, or it's a very different sort of thing. We still have a problem, it's just a very different sort of problem. That's sort of what I was driving. An interesting sort of thing to say.
Sissy?
Can I go back to the baby case, the baby in the
pond? Oh, yeah, okay.
So I walk on the street, minding my business, and lo and behold, I see a baby lying naked by the side of the pond in great distress. Now surely, I mean, I believe I'm under very strong duty, in fact, as it happens, enforceable duty, to help that baby by calling an ambulance. Just to clarify what you think, is it your view that my duty would be the stronger for the fact that I, in the case where I am the one who lifted the baby out of the pond in the first instance?
Yeah.
You see, I mean, initially I was very taken by the wife. Well, not really taken by the example.
I mentioned that.
Yeah. By the principle that the example was meant to illustrate. And then I said, well, hold on. I mean, no one, it seems to me, as an individual, is under a duty to provide continuing assistance to a woman who happens to be resourceless.
Right.
So I suppose what I'm trying to grapple with badly is the thought that there might well be general duties of assistance. There are cases where in discharging those general duties of assistance we harm the beneficiary of those duties in a way that would impose on us a further duty to help, at least in the short term, but perhaps not beyond the limits that no one in any event is under a duty to go for the sake of helping others. Then there are cases where we discharge a general duty of assistance in a way that does not harm the intended beneficiary. And then there is a further question that arises to do you see what I mean there?
Yeah. Let's take first the non-harming case, just where it's a general duty of assistance. So, I didn't mean that you have a duty to adopt the child, but the...
That's crazy.
That would be. No, but it seems to me you have a duty not just to alleviate the most immediate source of the distress, but to ensure that, in some sense, the child is out of danger. And that was the point of my saying you're mixed into this for more than...
Yeah, but I don't think your duty... I typically mean that... the justification, I might have misunderstood what you said, but the justification for that duty lay at least in part in the fact that I was the one who did the rescue. So I'm thinking about the case where I didn't do the rescue. In fact, Bloggs did the rescue, but Bloggs decided he's busy, he can't be bothered to ring the ambulance, and I happened to be there.
I don't think it matters whether you're the one who pulled the baby out or whether you appear on the scene. It's simply that you're sort of implication in the situation that I think matters. Your being on the scene is what generates the duties that are more extensive than you might prefer, give you a claim on the assistance of others. But in the absence of others' help, you're not entitled to simply walk away and say it's not fair that I have this.
So then we have, if I may come back. So then we have cases where, in discharging the duty of assistance, we harm the beneficiary. So either directly we break the kid's arm, or indirectly we take away the woman's source of support. But I think there are limits to what we may do, it seems to me, to what we must do for the sake of others, even if we are in part responsible for the predicament. And certainly in those cases where we carried out the rescue in order to benefit them. So I think that's the line that you could press against Uwe.
Yeah, no, this is a very, I think it's a hard issue in politics, the sort of the walk away point. When can you wash your hands? And it's clearly not at the moment of first convenience, and it's not at the point of sort of moral, emotional, or financial bankruptcy, but where along that spectrum? And I don't have an answer.
Lots of people want to come in on that.
I'm sorry.
So there's Helen.
If they have an answer.
Gentleman in the grey shirt, and Victor.
I just wonder, surely it's not a matter of impulse in Cecile's case. Given that presumably anybody who could rescue the baby ought to, and the initial rescuer has already borne some cost, right? So Cecile's going to get a lovely outfit wet as she drags the baby out. It seems more than fair that then other people would sort of do the next bit. And that seems particularly true with intervention as well.
But what if they don't? Do you still have the duty? So I'm insisting that you do. Mm. You have a duty to continue efforts, even if others are not doing their fair share.
Right, okay.
It's certainly true that you have a fair claim on the resources of others.
But I thought you thought that it fell particularly to the person who...
it doesn't depend anymore on the cause of responsibility,
right? I acknowledge that you're being the rescuer doesn't, I think, determine whether you have the duties.
I mean, it also depends on how you construe the duty. It would be weird to say, oh, well, all you're under duty to do is get him out of the pond. What you do after that, that's entirely to decide or not. But it seems to me that we understand that duty as a duty to help the child in such a way that he's out of at least immediate danger. We could say the same, of the woman. So if, upon the husband being killed, suppose the house, gets bumped, blah, 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 then it would be a duty to have her over for the night or to provide her with shelter, at least in the immediate future, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you might be able to, parry, that objection.
Yeah. I think my point was basically to say, Helen, just to sort of say it again. Just because you say, I now accept, you accept that the causal chain that doesn't matter if we're sort of now symmetrically situated. But I think Helen's point is stronger than that. It's that your duty is lesser.
Yeah.
It's not just that all the people standing around now have the same duty, so I don't have any special duty because I was the one who picked the baby out of the pond in the first place. It's that my duty is now lesser than theirs because I've done something already. So, you know, having already borne a cost, I might now have a claim that, okay, whoever does the next bit, if no one else is going to do it, I might have the secondary duty, but I might have a lesser duty to do the next bit because I've done some already. It's a slightly different point to the one you responded to, I think.
Okay, right. No, I mean, my considered attitude towards causal responsibility is it's relevant but neither necessary nor sufficient for sort of full moral reparative duties. And one has a duty of rescue whether or not one caused the injury. I mean, that's simply a nature of the case. Others also, it may or may not, the causal responsibility in this particular case may not particularize the duty to you. Anybody else also has that duty. But I do think there is causal significance to being sort of already in the chain of rescue. And, this is this general background methodological principle of trying to square a moral theory with, in some sense, the kind of sociology of moral practice. Yes, it's a mess.
We have three.
I think the world is a mess.
We have three more fingers and not a lot of time. So could you just please all, Victor, David, and Laura, state your input, and then maybe you have last word.
It might be worth thinking about what happens when you could do more for the people that you've harmed and then rescued, or for other people. So imagine that there's the baby that you pull out of the pond, and there's all these other babies stacked up alongside the pond that have been pulled out by other people. Do you have any particular reason to pick out this baby that you've saved to do more for this baby than these other babies stacked
up? Especially if you can help some of the other babies more.
It's not absurd at all.
That's exactly the right thought about the war case too, right? So you go to war with someone, you make them really badly off, but better off than they were under this brutal dictatorship. Now there's all these other people that you could help.
Yeah.
Do you have any special reparative obligations to this state that you've harmed when you could just provide humanitarian aid to a whole load of other people, right? And that's a real practical world problem where it's not obvious that the answer is that you should reconstruct the state that you've gone and harmed for these kinds of reasons. So whether causal responsibility is important has a very significant real-world implication about what you should do in these conflict cases.
David.
Okay, so I think that maybe there is a way to say yes to that reason. So one of the questions is why this kind of just complete fairness account that, you know, we have a couple of people just seems phenomenologically so wide of the mark, right? This, you know, that somebody who's been involved in a rescue, pulling a child out of a pond or rescuing an animal or whatever, phenomenologically, you feel exactly as Chris says, you've meddled in that, you feel engaged in that, right? You don't feel as though, well, I've done this bit, now, you know, on fairness grounds, somebody else should. You want to be the one who does different things, you want to stay engaged in that. Now, why might that be? Well, one reason that might be is that being the rescuer of that child or that person establishes a kind of strong kind of relationship between you. Maybe a little bit akin to the relationship that you have in situations of friendship or family. You know, so with friends, we don't say, well, you know, this friend of mine, Jesus, I've been helping him for all this time. On fairness grounds, somebody else ought to take over. No, he's my friend. I want to help him more. And it seems to me that the situations of rescue, phenomenologically, that's how we feel that. You pull someone out of a pond, it's your rescue, and you want to be the one. You feel that kind of further obligation, which I think is a little bit similar to the obligation we feel to friends.
Yeah, no, you might be simultaneously resentful as well. But,
right, which you also have in...
Yeah.
Laura, very quick last word.
Yeah, okay. It's I think in support of what David just said. So, to the effect that considerations of fairness do not seem to have much of a bearing on cases of rescue when we are acting on our duty to help those in need, so long as this is not costly to oneself, to ourselves. So think about a case in which you have five bystanders, five children in the pond. Now, if it's not too costly to yourself to save all the five, then I think you should save all the five. You are under a duty to save all the five, even though fairness considerations, each person should save one. But, you know, if you act out of that particular duty, you might have to save all the five, even if four guys. And that's not unfair. That's just in the nature of the duty. So long as it's not too costly to yourself, you should do it.
Do you understand? Last word?
Thank you very much. I feel like the child being pulled out of the pond now. Yeah.